And good morning, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Other Side of Midnight. I'm your host, Richard C. Hoagland, and this morning I have a surprise for you. I know I promised the surprise a little earlier, but as they used to say at this time of year, better late than never, and please don't get me started on the 12 days of Christmas, because, well, that's a whole other show. Before I introduce my guest this morning, I do want to say one thing about this latest furor over Art. Apparently, Art had another episode of somebody shooting something at him last night. And that's about all I know. I know he's fine. I know police were called. I know that he decided to take the night off to recuperate from, you know, whatever happened. And that, but physically, he is fine. I must say that this pattern is disturbing. We are living in very disturbing times. And the thing that we're going to be talking about this morning is not to give in to the disturbing times. In fact, we're actually going to be talking about some modalities that are the exact opposite, that are basically the cure for disturbing times. But we will get to that in a while. How do I characterize Stan Tenen? Stan Tenen and I met very serendipitously, something like 30-plus years ago, at an institute in California called the Stanford Research Institute, which is a private think tank south of San Francisco on the peninsula, not far from Stanford itself. And the reason we met is that we both had a colleague there, Dr. Lambert Dolphin, who had a very eclectic series of interests. And it turns out that at the same time that he was intrigued with the idea that there might be an artificial civilization on Mars, he was also very intrigued with the idea that there might be an interesting meta-message starting in the text of Genesis that could be resolved and decoded mathematically and geometrically, which is basically the thesis of my friend and colleague Stan Tenen's work for the last many, many decades. I can do no better to characterize what we're going to talk about this morning than to begin with the idea of how Genesis preserves a science of consciousness, a term that we've talked about on this show many, many times, both in geometry and gesture. So let me give you a little bit of background. Stan Tenen was born in 42, raised in a non-religious home in Brooklyn, New York, and has always been driven by, which I think most of us are, curiosity. Stan has this interesting ability to recognize patterns. He's a pattern amplifier, a pattern matcher. He has a BS in physics and holds numerous patents. In fact, I might ask him about a couple of the patents because he worked at a very famous company. I don't know whether he wants to mention the name of the company, but he did some interesting work there. Anyway, Stan is currently the director of research for the Meru Foundation, and we'll discuss what Meru is and how it got its name and what it does in a few moments. The book on the results of his last 30-plus years of research, actually much more, maybe going on 40, The Alphabet That Changed the World, How Genesis Preserves a Science of Consciousness in Geometry and Gesture, was published in 2011 by North Atlantic Books, my publisher, as you may note. Stan now lives and works with his wife, Lavana, in Marin County, California, where I understand tonight it's unusually warm, and the fact is there is an El Nino coming. Stan, welcome to The Other Side of Midnight.
Hi, Richard. It's great to be on.
It's great to finally have you on. It's been through some vicissitudes that we finally got you sitting in front of a microphone. God, where do I want to begin? Why don't you start by telling me from your perspective what you were doing in visiting Dr. Dolphin at SRI the day that we met?
I don't actually remember, other than I was generally briefing him on what I had found, which was a pattern in a sequence of letters at the beginning of the Hebrew text of Genesis.
Okay. So then let's jump in there. We've all read at one time or another Genesis. I mean, even people who are not Christians, people who are not Jews, people who are not anything, it's one of the great books on the planet. You know, you have got to read Genesis in order to get a perspective on history, on culture, on who we are. What began you, that's a really terrible phrase. What began for you this curiosity about the text of Genesis and what might lie beneath the text?
Well, I was working in Cambridge, Massachusetts, as a physicist for a small optics company. And
do we want to mention them?
Block Engineering in Cambridge, Mass., also Block Research, Brock Associates, which was their research arm. And I had a fight with the guy that ran the company, Myron Block, and he fired me.
Hmm.
And then the vice president entered the office and told him he couldn't fire me because he'd never given me a vacation. So he'd have to wait until I took a vacation before he could fire me. So I took a vacation, and when I got back, of course, the issue had passed. Well, it turned out this was in August 1967, and in June 67, the Israelis and the Palestinians went, and the Egyptians and all went to war in the June 67 war.
Remember it well.
And when that announcement was made, all of a sudden, people from this company in Cambridge, Mass., started disappearing. And I found out that what Myron had done was hire people from Israel who were at MIT studying because they were cheap. He could pay them less than you have to pay people living here who demanded full salaries. So there was a whole team of Israeli scientists and scholars who were working at MIT that Block had hired.
Kind of like one step, up from grad student slave labor, as we all talk about it.
Yeah. It was an angle. It worked. Everybody was happy, I guess. Anyhow, when the war broke out, these were senior people, and they were pilots. And so they immediately went out to Logan Airport and flew to Israel and joined their units.
Mm-hmm.
And when they got back, a friend of mine said he decided to move to Israel and invited me to visit. And I said, sure, when I get a chance, I'll come and visit. And that had happened in June. In August, I got fired, and I had 3 weeks to do nothing. And I was single and had no responsibilities, plenty of money. I took the then-still-running New York-Boston shuttle to Idlewild Airport. It wasn't Kennedy Airport yet. I think they changed it later. And I got on an LL flight, which was delayed all night in a rainstorm. It went to Paris, and then it went to Tel Aviv. It was a fantastic flight. It took twice as long as it should have. It was chaos. It was overcrowded. Everyone was fighting over the food. I sat down next to some Christian missionary, and it was very quiet, but I was the only quiet flight on the plane.
Hmm.
Anyhow, we arrived, and we were over the French Alps, and the pilot comes on, and he says, we'll be landing at Lourdes Airport, it wasn't Ben-Gurion yet, at 12:30. So I called the stewardess over and said, what does he mean, 12:30? And she says, he's going to land at 12:30 and 30 seconds. I said, okay. And then I look out the window, and I feel the plane. Not a flap moves. Nothing changes. He went on a glide path from northern Italy onto the tarmac and hit the ground at 12:30.
Oh, my God.
They just come back from a war.
Wow.
They thought they were still, you know, fighting something. They were doing precision flying.
Wow.
Anyhow, it was a crazy trip. I was dead tired. I got a cab. I said to the cabbie, take me to Jerusalem, of course. And he drops me at the gate nearest the western wall to the temple at 5 a.m. or 6 a.m. It's just becoming daybreak. The Israelis had just cleared the plaza. They'd taken possession of the area in June, and this was August, I think. And it was pretty quiet. And a guy comes up to me, and he puts a cardboard hat on my head because I wasn't wearing a hat. And I'm walking towards the wall, and I'm looking at the scene, and there were these very happy, very proud Israeli soldiers and citizens, and then there were very glum and upset-looking Palestinians. And it just flashed in my mind, you know, this isn't going to work. These folks don't like each other.
Hmm.
And so I made a spontaneous prayer. I said, if there's anything I can do to let there be peace, let me know. And to let you know I'm serious, I'm not cutting my hair until there's peace, which I only did once in a therapy session very early on because that's what they had me do, but I haven't cut my hair since the early 70s. So I get back to tour the country, incredible situation. They were still building the country. It was 67. It was pretty early on. I get back east.
You mean back to Boston?
And I get back to Boston, and I discovered that they're running these rerun episodes of The Prisoner, which was Patrick McGoohan's series that was done for the BBC.
Yes.
And it was this mystical thing about a village, and the guy gets kidnapped, and there's spies. Well, there was only 16 episodes that they made for the BBC, but CBS needed 17 for the season. So they had to make an extra episode. So they filmed an extra episode of the Prisoner series without Patrick McGoohan, without the star, without the village, without any of the sets, or some of the characters, but not many. And it was called Do Not Forsake Me, Oh My Darling. It was a complete outlier. And in the middle of this program, up on the screen comes a code. And that triggered a thought in my mind. I don't know how or why. And it came into my mind, I've got to look at Genesis. I don't read Hebrew. So I searched the house. I remembered they'd given me a copy of the Hebrew Bible in Hebrew. The Hebrew-English edition at the time was the Sansino edition, was popular.
When you were in Israel, you say?
No, this was when I got back. Actually, my neighbor had given me a copy of the Hebrew Bible when I was bar mitzvah, and I'd never been back to the synagogue since. So I found I packed it away on the back steps in my apartment in Boston, and I dug it out, and it fell open to the first line of Genesis, and my eyes fell on the first line. Now, I didn't read Hebrew. I could read the alphabet. So my eyes fell on the letters. Now, you know...
You mean the geometric shape of the letters themselves?
I could read the letters one by one, A, B, C, D, Aleph, Bet, Gimel. I could recognize the names of the letters, but I couldn't read the language. The words, I didn't know. The translation was there, but I couldn't read the Hebrew as a language. This is a sequence of letters. So my eyes fell on the letters. And that's why I saw there was a pattern in the letters.
So let me stop you there.
Other people who could read the text wouldn't see the pattern in the letters because they'd see the words.
Let me stop you. So you go to Israel right after the 67 war. You then come back. That obviously was some kind of a life-changing experience, that whole
trip.
Well,
I made this spontaneous prayer for peace. I didn't know I was doing that. I was at a holy spot. To the Western traditions, the last remnant of Solomon's temple, and I said, "Let me help if I can help to make peace."
So you get back to the States and you see this episode from the prisoner, and in the episode,
a year later, it's almost to the day. I think this added episode gets added to the series. Levana, do you remember it? Oh, sorry, I thought she was asking me. So you see
this code, and suddenly Genesis pops into your mind, having nothing to do.
That's the point I can't explain. The picture of the code on the McGoohan show on television has nothing to do with the Genesis code, but seeing that code, which didn't exist when I was in Israel, they made that extra episode.
Right.
That triggered my thinking. It's almost as if when I made that prayer, that episode came into existence. If you want to get really metaphysical.
Okay.
Now, I wasn't thinking anyway like that at the time.
And so you have a physics background. You don't have a linguistic or a code or an English or whatever.
I have a B.S. in physics from what was Brooklyn Polytech. It's now part of NYU. A minor in math. It was a B.S. It's worth nothing. I worked as a physicist in electro-optics at Raytheon in Sylvania and this company, Block Engineering, General Laser, and generally in the Boston area for quite a while. And then I had this experience. And
so you have to root around in the house after this idea, Genesis, pops into your head. You have to go hunting for a copy of the Bible, for the Old Testament.
Right. I didn't know if I even had a copy. I found an English King James someplace that was on the bookshelf. I didn't look at it either. And I found the Hebrew Bible that my neighbor had given me as a gift when I was bar mitzvah that I had never opened. It was in a box that I had put stuff in when I moved from my parents. I'd never unpacked it. It was sitting on the back landing.
Now, when you thought Genesis, why did you think, I can't look at the King James English version, I have to go back to the original Hebrew? What made that connection in your mind?
Well, there's a dozens of different English translations, and nobody agrees on it. There's only one Hebrew text.
Okay. So as a scientific...
You're going to look at a source. Yeah, it was my sense of the translations. You wouldn't look at a translation of Shakespeare to look for coding in Shakespeare.
Okay. Just want to clear that up. So
I didn't know any of this. I was just curious. It was just a thought. So I opened the text, and it falls open to the first line of Genesis, and you know if you can't read a language, like you're watching a video from Russia, and it says Aeroflot on the side of the plane, and you don't really know Cyrillic. You know the letters, but you don't know the language. You sort of dope them out. You can compare them with the Aeroflot, and you can make it out.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what I was doing with the Hebrew text. I was looking at the sequence of letters, and I noticed that some of the letters repeated themselves. So I got a bunch of backgammon chips and wrote the letters out on them and started making patterns of the letters in the order in the text, but in different rows and columns and spiral patterns. And I spent a lot of time making meaningless patterns, and I took Polaroid pictures of them. There was no computer at the time. And I got patterns that were suspicious. There's one that I have in my book that I show, which has six lobes to it, and it's symmetrical. And eventually I refined that pattern, and I realized, and I think it's posted up on the screen on your website, I realized that it was a regular pattern.
Do we know which number it is?
Let me look at the screen, and I'll tell you which one you've talked about.
Because for everybody who doesn't know where we're looking, you go to othersideofmidnight.com, go to the upper right-hand corner, Radio with Pictures, click on that. That will take you to tonight's guest page. And on tonight's guest page, I have a series of images, graphics, from Stan's book, labeled 1, 2, 3, et cetera, et cetera. So which image should we be looking at?
Image number 2. The first line of the text of Genesis.
So we click on that.
Translated in the beginning. In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. And if you look at that sequence of letters and you don't know the language, and you just notice the sequence, you find you can divide it up into four families.
Okay.
I'll use the English names, R and L, T and F, H and M, and B and Y. And they're not exact cognates. And the reason they're paired up like that is because those letters are in symmetrical positions in the alphabet. See, I was so desperate, I had no idea what was going on. I literally took a Rubik's Cube and wrote the letters of the alphabet on the Rubik's Cube. There's 27 cubies. If you count the one in the middle, you can't get to it. It's really just a hub. And there's 27 letters in the full alphabet. And when I did that, I realized that there were letters in mirror image positions. The R's were opposite the L's. The H's were opposite the M's. The T's were opposite the F's. And so I
This is on the face of a cube.
Yeah, this is number one on your pictures.
Okay.
On your website. And I took the symmetries of the alphabet on the cube, which it took me a long time to even think to do, and applied them to the first verse, and it divided the first verse into four separate clusters of letters. The R's and the L's, the resh is the 201th letter, and the lamed is the 102th letter in base 3. Their mirror image counts.
Now, we already established, I think, that you kind of have had this hobby of looking at patterns and grokking an old Heinlein expression, that there's a meta pattern behind a pattern. What drove you to do all this work in a language you couldn't read, on a text that you didn't understand in Hebrew, just focusing on the letters and began to arrange them in these strange, like putting Hebrew letters on a cube is not something that everybody would do.
In high school, I was on the math team, and I never got to compete. I was not good enough. The captain of that math team turned out to be the last CEO of Metropolitan Life Insurance. That's the quality of people that I was surrounded by. I wasn't in that league. But I had the teacher of that class, Abner Mendelson, was a person who had worked on the Manhattan Project. And then he was a high school math teacher. And he was drilling the math team. And he taught us the techniques of visual pattern recognition. If you couldn't answer the question before the teacher had finished putting it on the blackboard, you never got to compete. You were a loser. You had to get it back quickly. So I was primed to recognize visual patterns and to do these kinds of experiments. I had been drilled in it. and I was surrounded by people that really made you work. They were a lot smarter than me.
So somehow in your subconscious, your pattern recognition sense, your spidey...
My alarms went off and said that this sequence of letters doesn't make sense. This can't be only words. And the more I researched the history of the Hebrew alphabet and the history of the text and the Kabbalistic tradition and the Greek Platonic tradition and the related the Islamic and Sufi traditions, the more Christian parallels, the more I researched it, the more I realized that it was a valid thing to do. And when I started getting results, I was able to recognize what they represented eventually. Initially, I didn't know what I was looking at. You wouldn't tell that from that Rubik's Cube and that first pattern of letters from the first verse, the next verse, the next part, the number three, if you write the letters out on a bead chain in order and curl them up so they pair off as best you, and make it as tight as you can.
So wait, hang on. We want to now go to Radio with Pictures, link number three. Click on
correct.
That. And what are we looking at here? It looks like... I don't know.
We're looking at the sequence of letters in the first verse of Genesis laid out in order on a spiral, on a torus, on a donut.
Okay.
And when you do that, they all pair off, and the pairing is so strong, even though you don't know anything about the pattern or anything about the letters or anything about the purpose of the whole thing, the pattern is so strong that if you were to cover one letter, you could uniquely replace it simply by reference to the other letters in all but one case.
So it looks like a code.
Exactly. You can't replace letters if there's not a pattern. If it's determined, then it's a code. It's a meaningful pattern.
Let me stop you there. Are you, in history, the first guy who's seen this code laid out in Hebraic letters? Who was someone else that did this?
I would assume this is how it was originally presented. The first word of Genesis, Bereshis, translated in the beginning, can also be translated by means of a woven matrix, by means of a woven fabric. The text is a textile. The patterns in Genesis were woven. In the ancient world, if you wanted to make hyperdimensional models, four-dimensional surfaces, you wove them. You got floppy sombreros. That's how you could research higher than three-dimensional forms in the ancient world without a computer.
You've taken a huge leap from our three-dimensional reality to hyper-dimensions. How do we get there?
I'm explaining how they came to do this. If you needed to model hyper-dimensional forms, one way you could do it is by weaving and crocheting and that kind of thing.
Okay.
And Exodus tells us that to make the Torah, they had to know how to weave and broder and brocade.
Oh, okay.
The text was woven. If you read the text, the stories in the Bible tell you how to handle the text in the message.
So basically you're saying that in Genesis you kind of got into the idea that there may be another set of messages in the text that wasn't the plain text, in the beginning, etc., but actually depended on the letter positions themselves.
Yeah, I'm saying that this is a mathematical geometric form. It unfolds. It's embryonic. It grows. It unfurls. It's fractal. It's modeling a living system. It's been taught that the Torah is a living thing, and this has qualities of a living system. It's self-embedded. It's reflexive. It has qualities of compactness, and it has geometric qualities that are essential for carrying information and preserving it.
Okay, so
it's what you could have done in the ancient world. It doesn't require any modern technique.
So what happened next in your search?
Well, I tried to make the pattern as compact as I could, and I got the pattern number right next to it on your site, which is, let me pull it down.
Link number four.
Link number four. Excuse me?
Click on link number four.
Number four. And number four I call a Shushan flower. Shushan means six. It's a six florets flower. Three double florets. So it's a Sushan flower.
Is it also a six petal flower?
The cube is the matrix on which the six petals emerge.
Okay.
So if you go through the center of the cube to each face, you spiral out to each face, flip along the edge, and spiral back in. The two smaller drawings on the right and left show actual.
At the bottom. Okay.
And what you've got, and if you go in my book, there's something called the Lost Wasp, which shows how you can unfurl the platonic forms and embryonic form.
Something called the what?
Lahav Swath. Lahav. Okay. And what it is a sequence of geometric forms that unfurl embryologically, like an embryo. Point, line, surface, volume, hypervolume. And when you do that, you get the five. You get other explanations for other discussions in Kabbalistic literature. We don't have to go there now. But what you get here is a way of looking at the letters on that form, on the Shushan flower, are the letters of the first verse of Genesis in order. And as you can see, the opposite pairs are mirror images of each other. Each one is a reflection. So the sequence of letters is actually forming this box.
This is a more elaborate version of your Rubik's Cube presentation.
It's not a Rubik's Cube. It's a hypercube or a cube octahedron, but it's related.
Okay.
And what you can see from this is that if you connect the head and tail of the first verse, the forms are described as an Ouroboros, a snake that eats its tail. If you connect it up this way, you get mirror images on opposite sides. That's the form that defines a torus and a three torus. A two torus is I'm getting a little tongue tied here. To make a two torus, you take a square. A two torus is an ordinary donut, and you connect the left and right sides, which makes a tube. Then you connect the top and the bottom of the tube, and it makes a donut.
Okay.
Well, if you do that with six sides, with three pairs, you get left to right, top to bottom, and front to back. And when you do that, all the letters in the first verse are determined, they're paired up, and they cluster in this form.
Okay, I tell you what, we're at
the
bottom.
The details are in the books. It's a little hard to do it on.
No. And look, everybody's going to have to go and look at the Meru site, the Meru Foundation site, which is linked under... That's actually just above Stan's bio tonight, and look at these, and it takes a lot of reading to begin to grasp the magnitude. So let me read a couple of testimonials from the beginning of your work. These now go back decades. I have one here from Joseph Schultz, Ph.D., who was Professor Emeritus of the Oppenstein Brothers Distinguished Professor of Judaic Studies at the University of Missouri in Kansas City. He said some years ago, Stan Tenen's discovery of the geometric forms and the mathematical symbols that lie behind the Hebrew letters in the text of the Hebrew Bible is revolutionary, and its implications, once spelled out, could equal the importance of the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls and perhaps even surpass it. Just hold it there.
Can I make a quick summary statement? I'm saying that if you pair off the letters in the first verse of Genesis, it folds up into a form which we are going to shortly discover generates all of the letters used to write the text.
Fascinating.
The first thing you do in a code is to give the code. You give the keys. You have the starting point. The first thing you have to give when you have an alphabet is the letters.
Yep.
What we get from this form is a model hand, which when you make gestures, generates all the Hebrew letter shapes.
Okay, we will get into the hand stuff, but we do have to take a break here at the bottom of the hour. One other surprise tonight is Bobby Bright, who is the gentleman, the song maker, the composer from Australia, who composed one of the alternate forms of our original Other Side of Midnight theme. He also has sent us some remarkable music, a whole album, in fact. So we're going to be playing some of his music in the breaks tonight. This one you're going to want to listen to. You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland. We shall return.
fall over the sea. Every night in limbo, got a hold on me. Kites are on the table, playing around the sea. Rearrange their places, Lord.
Let me read you another interesting review of Stan's work. This is from Rabbi Dr. Meyer Sendor. There are certain texts for a scholar of the Kabbalah that are almost impossible to interpret and to read properly without some awareness of what Stan Tenen is doing and his explorations in these sacred geometries. It's as if you get the key to understanding the text once you grasp what Stan is really talking about. There are other scholars of the history of the Kabbalah, as well as practicing Kabbalists, who are excited about Stan's work for this very reason. His work is very solidly grounded and disciplined thought. It's important to appreciate this and distinguish this from other things that are out there in the world. Let me introduce now Lavana, who is Stan's wife and his colleague and assistant and general factotum, and has been with him for as long as Stan and I've known each other. When we played music at the break, Stan made some mention that someone has actually composed music using this code to basically represent tones.
Yes, actually.
And that was not one of them.
His name is Daniel Gill, and we met him, maybe 10, 15 years ago when we were still living in Massachusetts. Daniel is a graduate of Berklee School of Music. He's got he's a performer, he's a composer. But when we met him, we were looking for somebody to work with the first verse of Genesis with the letters and turn it into music. Now, if anyone has if any one of your listeners has already seen our stuff and seen our DVDs, there was another composer many years ago who composed a microtonal version based on the sequence of Hebrew letters in the first verse of Genesis. But we wanted something different. And Daniel is a classical composer. He's an orchestral composer. Well, when we first talked to him, he was kind of reluctant to do it. He didn't think that it would be much of an interesting project because it seemed sort of tame to him. But he agreed. And so he took the text. Now, he is a yeshiva-educated person, as well as being a graduate of Berklee School of Music, as I said. So he brought his life's background of being involved in these sacred texts to his work as a musician and as a composer. Well, he started working, and he worked with the letters, assigning them different tones, assigning them different different lengths of the time that you hold it. He created a system for bringing out some of the patterns musically that were in the first three verses, actually, is as far as he got.
Mm-hmm.
Well, from going from being reluctant, he went, I think we got four phone calls that evening. The last one was something like, 12:30 or 1 a.m., which was really unusual for a bedroom town in Sharon, Massachusetts, believe me. Saying, there's music happening here. There is music here. You know, it's like he was totally stunned. And from that point on, he was hooked.
I mean, what are the odds that you would take a random verse of anything and be able to set the letters to musical tones and have it come out coherent, let alone sounding interesting?
I don't really know, but I do know that, of course, from his point of view, as someone who went to yeshiva and who's lived in that atmosphere, there was no way that the letters of Genesis could be random. Studying the letters in addition to the text is a traditional thing to do. You know, it's accepted that the letters are special and that the letters have, additional meanings besides making words. Nobody knows what they are, or nobody knows a whole lot about it, but they know that it's an accepted frame of mind in which to approach this project. Well, anyway, so Daniel completed the Creation Overture, which you can hear for free on his own website, which I'd like to give over the air. We didn't have a chance to type it in.
Oh, sure.
But it's very simple. It's www.jewsmusic.com. That's JEWSMUSIC, just like it sounds.
I wonder if when Stan and I are talking, I can actually go there and play some of this music, because now that you've titillated everybody, they're going to want to hear the music.
I can play it on this computer, I think.
I think it's probably better if Richard, if you can do it, or
should I try?
Try,
well,
please.
Somebody else do it. Actually,
yeah, better somebody else do it, or you can do it.
Well, let's see what happens.
That's not it, Stanley. Oh, you got it. Okay.
Let's see if it'll play. I don't hear anything. Let's start over.
Okay.
Lavanna, why don't you give me the website again, and I'll try to call up here.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, why don't you give it to me here, and I think we can get a much better version.
Okay.
All right.
Okay. Stop it, Stanley.
Yeah, coming through the phone, yeah. It doesn't work too well. So give it to me slowly.
Okay. It's www.jewsmusic.com.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. And I'm going to tell you which link it is.
All right. I've got it now, Daniel Gill. And
let's just do new tab so I can go there.
This is real-time radio, folks. Would it be under recordings? would it be under recordings?
It is under...
I see the Four Worlds, the Mystical Awakening, Songs of Chasidim, the Creation Overture.
The Creation Overture, that's
okay.
It.
Clicking on Creation Overture. And then we do this, and let's hope that it works. It does.
I don't hear anything.
No, you won't, because I'm... Oh, my gosh, this is fascinating.
I don't know what that is.
That's the first four verses of Genesis?
That particular section is, I think, the first... that actually is the first word.
The first word?
Yeah. He takes 10 minutes worth of music to go through the first three verses.
Oh, my gosh.
The system, I can't in detail repeat for you exactly what his system is, but because I've forgotten the details, frankly. but
okay.
Basically, if you know his system, you can go backwards from the score and wind up with the first three verses of Genesis. That's exactly what you're hearing.
Amazing.
So anyway,
okay. Hang on.
Okay.
I'm looking for my volume control, and I can't quite find it in real time. Anyway, that's fantastic. That's amazing. That is contained in the first verses of Genesis.
Yes.
That's just absolutely astounding. So, Stan, if we can bring you back in, there is a code in Genesis, and you just heard part of it. So
Go
ahead.
The reason we decided to play it musically, it was to verify that what I thought I was intuiting visually was actually there. The first version of this, I had a Casio keyboard. It was one of these little portable toy things in at the time. That's all there was. And I played it out note by note. And I decided to myself it had structure. This with Daniel, it is much more sophisticated and much later. But yeah, we originally put it to music to see if we could discern if there was anything like a pattern.
This is so reminiscent of me looking at images from Mars and looking at geometric patterns on the surface of another planet and saying, "Oh my God, that has to be artificial." The pattern.
Well, we now know what the geometry is, which is even more important. This is the geometry of life. This is the golden rule. Now, the crazy story about the lunatic that we had to deal with, that was dealing with the number. It's not the number. It's the principle. Don't do to others what's hateful to you. Do unto others what you would like them to do to you. Turn the other cheek. Those golden rules, if you follow them, are what generates these patterns.
Hmm.
And so what they're literally doing is projecting a way of seeing the universe, a way of living in the world, on anybody who engages the text, whether you read it or listen to it or explore it visually, weave it. It doesn't matter. It's going to rub off on you, this self-referential, this wheel of karma, this idea of what goes around comes around, action and reaction, Gog and Magog. And if you master that, then you're honoring the last of the five Ten Commandments. Those are the five final commandments. They're all don't be jealous. Don't steal, don't rob, and they're all based on the way our mirror neurons work.
Hmm.
Yeah, and this is what we mean, why we called the book what we did. The alphabet that changed the world, how Genesis preserves a science of consciousness in geometry and gesture. This is a manifestation, you're listening to the structure of that science of consciousness when you listen to the music.
Well, let me.
Beginning, it unfurls.
At the risk of embarrassing you, let me read what Ralph Abraham, PhD, who was the former chair of mathematics at UC Santa Cruz, said a few years ago. Quote, "I've been following Stan's work for 2 decades. He has made crucial discoveries on the history of the alphabet, the deeper levels of meaning of sacred texts, and the role of mathematics in the history of consciousness. In my opinion, he is among the most important students of Kabbalah in recent times. I cannot recommend his work too highly." So let's go back to your work. Where did you go next after you started poking around with the idea that musical patterns is one way to apprehend this underlying subtext in Genesis?
Well, where did I go next? What I had to do was pull it all together, get to the bottom of it. I didn't have the initial principles. I had intriguing patterns, but I didn't know how they related to each other. I didn't know how they occurred historically. I didn't know what to do with them. It took years of reading and studying to get some sense of what was out there. I took it as far as I could on my own before I went to see what other results were. So I'd come up with some ideas. And I explored them. And the most important idea is that, well, there are two fundamental ideas. One is that everything in science and everything in metaphysics and spirituality is based on the golden rule. That's the foundation of everything. And
That's the do unto other rule.
Yeah, the idea is what goes around comes around. And explicit finding is that the Hebrew letters in particular, and a particular Hebrew alphabet, and likely also the Greek and Arabic letters in particular alphabets, come from hand gestures. And because they come
Back up. How do we get from Hebrew letters to holding your hands up and waving them around in the air?
Well, what you discover when you make these geometric models, as I describe in the book, I literally, it's hard to know how far to back up. We know that in the Greek tradition, supposedly Apollo created the Greek alphabet from an apple.
Okay.
And we also know the story of the apple in the Garden of Eden or some other fruit. There's all kinds of fruit that's described. But one of the fundamental ideas is an apple. And an apple is the culmination of an apple tree. An apple seed grows into a stem, into branches, and a fruit forms on it. And it's a part of it's a life cycle. It represents the whole life cycle.
And then if you pick it...
So I drew the culminating fruit in the pattern on the apple. There's a picture in my book where I take the 310 torus knot, which is one of the ways you can pair off the letters, similar to diagram 4 here. And I drew it on the surface of the apple. And I took the apple in my hand, and I realized, wait a minute, remember that old picture in the Gnostic literature of Hermes Trismegistos holding up the world in his hand with his thumb sticking up the South Pole? Remember that? You see that he holds it up in his hand?
Oh, yeah, okay.
Well, I did that to the apple. I stuck my thumb up the bottom of a plastic ice bucket apple, and noticed it fit exactly between the lines of the knot that was formed by pairing off the letters, and there were 6 of them. I took one of them out and put it on my hand and made gestures. And in each gesture, you could see the outline of a Hebrew letter. And not only that...
No, are we talking something similar to that game where you have a candle or a flashlight and you hold your hands up in front of it and you project it on a screen so that you see the...
That would work. That would work. Except the screen is your own eyes. And the hand is your own hand.
Okay.
The model is in your own hand. So you're always viewing the hand from your own perspective. And because it's your hand, it comes into your mind's eye. And as you move your hand and make gestures... You describe things. If you make the gesture for round, where you sort of cup a basketball, you literally see in sequence the Hebrew letters that spell the word round.
This is astonishing.
Each Hebrew letter has a name. Each Hebrew letter has a name.
So to make sure...
If you look in the dictionary at that name and treat it as a verb, you discover you see the shape of that letter when you make the gesture that corresponds to that name.
So wait a minute. Let me back up here. If what you're saying is that if you look at your hand gestures from the perspective of your own brain out through your two eyes, and you're holding your hands out in front, and you're making shapes, those shapes correlate to the Hebraic letter forms?
You can, yes, if you trace your, if you, you've got to sort it out. The first verse folds itself up into this geometric form, which includes 6 copies of this model hand. When you put the model hand on your hand and make gestures, you see the outline of all the different letters. You see each letter in a gesture that corresponds to the meaning of its name. And it turns out in Hebrew tradition today, if you go into a synagogue, people will put on a tefillin strap. And they wind it on their arm and on their hand and on their and their fingers, and you're supposed to see 3 letters. Well, the model I've recovered demonstrates all of the letters from the same principle.
Now, if we go to your website, Milvana, I think we're going to the same place. If you go to Meru.com, I'm sorry, Meru.org, www.meru.org, about halfway down the first page. On the right-hand side, there is a video of Stan making these gestures in terms of the letter shapes that he's just described. So you can see it visually if you, again, go to othersideofmidnight.com, click on Radio with Pictures in the upper right-hand corner. That takes you down to the guest page. Scroll down, go into the Meru link on the guest page just above Stan's bio. That takes you to the Meru.org site. On the right-hand side, halfway down, there is Stan making these gestures with his hands that correspond to the Hebrew letters. Amazing.
No, I understand that, Stan, about 15 years ago.
We weren't going to talk about that. But we do notice he has not cut his hair.
This is absolutely true.
Anyway, Stan, go ahead.
Well, the idea, so we had to find out everything we could about this hand model, and we were able to interpret Kabbalistic texts that refer to hand models, and we realized what must have happened. You know, if you ask a scholar, whether it's an academic scholar or a religious scholar today, what's the source of the Hebrew alphabet? They're going to say, well, it's the little letter Yud, the iota, the jot, the dot, the smallest letter, Yud. Yud means hand. And so people took that small truth, and it displaced the greater truth, that all of the letters come from a model hand, a whole hand. It's not that one letter means hand and that it's the smallest element of all the other letters. It's that there's a greater truth, that all of the letters come from gestures of a hand. Now, why would you do that? The reason you do that is just to be able to coordinate dance, whether it's a meditation or a dance in the world. Eventually, I read about Rumi's poetic description of the Mevlevi Sufi round dance. And if you read the description of the Sufi round dance, it matches the geometry in the first verse of Genesis.
Wait, the Sufi round dance,
which is the basis of the mystical tradition in Sufism, is in the first verse.
Which has nothing to do with Judaism or the Hebraic alphabet, supposedly.
Oh, it has everything to do with it, because all of these faiths are based on humility.
But I said supposedly.
And they're teaching humility to different populations in different ways.
Stan, I said supposedly. You have found connections that other people apparently have not seen. That's what's
non-trivial,
so amazing.
Non-trivial connections. It's easy to find the trivial connections. It's easy to find the mistakes, the superficial explanations, which is what we've all been satisfied with. But in fact, I'm saying the text of Genesis preserves, letter by letter, a sequence of gestures of a mental dance and an external dance, a Sufi dance, that leads to an experience of the transcendent in the real world. I'm saying that these meditational exercises can lead to the emergence of an objective activity in the real world. There's a connection between mind and body, between consciousness and physics, and this is the link, and it's in our mind's eye. Hmm. And this was known in the Western traditions for centuries. I sent you that quote I came upon recently that shows that the Greek tradition had the same model that I ultimately found, which is a model of the golden rule. As above, so below, what goes around comes around. You put those together, you get this particular geometry, you take it through the dimensions, you'll see on your page, number 6, shows how you can take this inverted T geometry, which we haven't talked about, and take it up through the dimensions to the model hand shape. And number 8, just below it, summarizes this idea of the two golden rules. As above, so below, and what goes around comes around. And that's exactly what Proclus describes Plato as describing in the Timaeus as the foundation of the Greek system. And no one knows that this is real.
Hmm. Well, there are a few people do, including a lot of people now listening to this show this morning, or this evening, or this afternoon, wherever on the planet you happen to be. So let's go back to the unfurling of this code, this mystery. After you got into the hand gestures, what happened next?
Well, it's hard to say. A lot of things are going on simultaneously.
It's a lot of years, yes, I know.
The most important thing to me was to unfurl this system as far as I could on my own and then read what the experts and the scholars said to see if I'd hit the same answers as they had. I was going to use what was currently known as a checksum on what I found. So I had to develop my theories first And along the way, they became more and more refined, and things became clearer. And eventually, we were able to write the book. So the book summarizes what happened over the next 10 or 15 years. And it, all we really did was put everything together and sort it out. We also produced a sequence of videotape lectures, mostly in the late 80s and in 1990s, which outlined the research as it was happening. So if you want to know what I was doing when, the videotape series, which are now DVDs, we document that. And then we moved from Marin County here north of San Francisco to Sharon, Massachusetts, which has an Orthodox Jewish population, people that have yeshiva educations. And I went and learned what was being taught traditionally, which I hadn't had access to before, at least not from people who could read the text directly. The musician Daniel Gill that we were talking about earlier did some of the translation. There's an appendix in the book, a short little piece where he translated it for us, and then started to use our findings. So it's a matter of interacting with people. And in interacting with the Orthodox Jewish world, I learned what had been preserved and what had been lost. Apparently, none of this is known currently. The last remnants of it seem to be traces go back about 200 years. It looks like when Napoleon liberated the Jews as citizens, he also persecuted Jewish leadership and attempted to replace Jewish and Christian leadership with his own leadership because he thought he was the sun god when he got back from Egypt.
Mm.
So he persecuted the rabbis. The rabbis in Russia allied with the Tsar. He literally hunted down and the rabbi that was the leader of the Hasidic tradition at the time died in the snows of Russia, burnt, and had to burn his own library to try to escape. So everything was lost around 1800, around 1810. And there's no traces I can find of a coherent discussion of these ideas that are any later than that.
Well, the pogroms,
these ideas,
the pogroms and the inquisitions roll through, and information is systematically destroyed because obviously there are people that don't want this kind of information out there.
Mostly destroyed in ignorance. It's just destroyed by people who don't see its value. Like the talent, like the terrorists in the Middle East now burning down the ark. The heritage of the Middle East is being destroyed. They're plowing down the ruins and burning the archives.
We are at the top of the hour.
And
so what we need to do is to take another break. What I'd like to do is to actually play some more of this amazing music, which is, remember, The Unfoldment of the Letters of Genesis, as done by Stan Tenen, set to music by his friend Daniel Gill, and this is what you get. You're on the other side of midnight. My name's Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return. On the other side of midnight, and my producer, Scott, whispered in our ears a very interesting question. We all know from common experience, if we play a game at parties called telephone, where you whisper in someone's ear, and it goes around a circle, and the next person repeats it in the next person's ear, and it goes around and goes around, and when it comes back to the original person, it represents nothing of the original message, the original whispering, the original whatever. Stan, are you there?
Yeah.
Okay. How do you know that the Hebraic text that you're decoding bear any similarity to Hebrew text going back thousands of years when this was originally composed, and that the code that you're finding is not just, you know, randomness projected against randomness?
Well, it's taken a long time to become confident that that's the case. Obviously, that's an open question. The discovery of these patterns, though, is the demonstration that they're real, that you can't make patterns out of nonsense this way.
In other words, a thousand monkeys cannot write the Encyclopedia Britannica given a billion years.
Not only that, but you don't end up with a meaningful model that does something. Even if you can find patterns in a text and you force fit it, it doesn't generally fold up into a form that generates shadows as hand gestures of all the letters used to write the text. That's a pretty hard thing to do by accident.
There are
discussions that describe this process, which have not been understood for centuries. Like the quote I sent you from Proclus. No one realizes that the Greek discussion is the same as the Hebrew discussion because they were translated in so very different times and ways.
Hmm.
It's the translations that keep varying. The coherence, the integrity of the biblical text is not that as good as people think. The oldest complete copy of the text is the Leningrad Codex, which is only about 1,000 years old and was composed by Karaite Jews who don't believe in the Talmud, and not many are left today. And it's only 1,000 years old. The older Aleppo Codex was partially destroyed when Israel came into being by the people who had it in Syria. There aren't really complete texts that go back much farther than that. But there are sections, and there are texts that quote parts of the Torah, of the Bible. The opening line is heavily quoted. It occurs many different places. And what we're using is the standard and most compact and most documented form.
Now,
but there could be mistakes.
Didn't you
and,
find...
And if there had been spurious letters, or if there had been letters added, I couldn't have made the toroidal pattern. Mm. There would have been a hole.
Okay.
You see, what we found is actually the proof that answers the question. What we found is the demonstration that these aren't random patterns.
Didn't you
find the claims of the rabbis are actually true?
All right. Didn't you find also that there are little taglets, or I forget what the technical term is, on the letter?
Yeah, they're decorations on the letter. They're called Keterim and Targim. Keterim means crowns and Targum means tags.
Okay.
Little markings on the tops of the letters. No one understands where they come from. We've been able to explain one set. They were so-called triple Targum, which are little crowns, Keterim. It turns out the letters that have these markings are on the corners of a tetrahedron that sits inside of the torus, just like your model to some extent. And each of the corners has a little triple crown, looks just like the decoration. And one set of letters has one triple crown, the next set has two, the next is three. So it literally counts off the axes of the figure. The crowns appear to preserve the coordinate system of the Rubik's Cube for viewing the letters.
So it has an internal self-correcting code.
Yeah, it's not random. We found an explicit meaning. That doesn't mean if that was the only fact we had, it wouldn't be good enough. But if you put 20 of these odd facts together, then you start to smell that there's something going on.
In other words, the probability of this being accidental or coincidence or you're projecting is, pardon the pun, astronomical.
Yes, it's more than a statistical. It's not even a statistical question. What we found are woven patterns, and the first word of the first verse says, by means of a woven network, and is a teaching that the text is ordered letter, word, verse, chapter, book. There's a hierarchical description of the text. We found that hierarchy, and it fits the descriptions. It's kind of an identification. And not only that, but what you get is meaningful and useful. You get a generating form for all the letters, and it's the one form that connects the mind and the world, our hand. The one form that stands equally in consciousness and in physics is our hand.
Now, you
and
mentioned...
Go
ahead.
It represents our will.
All right. You mentioned that you'd found parallels, which basically you think translate to the same meta-message in the ancient Greek. What about other cultures, other religions, other...
You'll find in one of the appendices to the alphabet that changed the world, there's a drawing called Churning the Ocean of Milk, which is a traditional Hindu drawing. Now, if you find Hindus and rabbis today who believe that each other, that they're connected, you'll have a hard time. Everyone thinks that Hinduism is kind of paganish and idolatrous, and Hebrews is kind of rational and and very strict and narrow. We're finding the same element in the Hindu tradition as we're finding in the Hebrew tradition. The continuous creation model that we have been drawing for about 30 years now turns out to match element by element the elements of churning the ocean of milk in the Hindu tradition. It's one of the appendices at the end of the book.
Well, this then starts to look like there was an ancient body of knowledge that got fragmented. And what we're seeing on the surface when we look at Judaism, Christianity, Islam.
The rabbis call it the Academy of Shem and Eber, and it's supposed to have existed before Abraham, and it's where the Hebrew patriarchs studied. Mythologically, no one knows if this is real, but there's a tradition that there is an earlier source. My guess is what we're looking at here is perennial tradition that was global, that was absorbed into the Egyptian system and taken, de-idolatrized by Moses and taken out and then became independent again. That we're looking at the remnants of what's been preserved, a perennial tradition. And it's a perennial tradition, and it's the same for everyone because it's logically minimal. It's not based on any idolatrous external image. It's based on a point, a line, and a circle.
So it's ultimately geometric and ultimately mathematical, and that's the...
Geometric, embryological, it's the it's a geometric embryology. After a point, line, surface, volume, hypervolume is a kind of geometric embryology.
But Stan, that points to some ancient, global, holistic knowledge that then got fragmented in various separate cultures and religions and traditions that we're looking at. That ultimately, I mean, this is pretty incendiary and fascinating stuff because
it means... Well, the most refined versions are... The Torah version is the most abstract and refined version. It's the reason why the one God of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam can claim the highest status is because it sits at the highest level of abstraction. It's the highest abstraction, and it subsumes all the other embodiments. It's not my culture against your culture. My God is bigger than your God. My God is a mountain. Your God is a cloud. We fight with each other. That's not it. It's that the Western tradition embodies the highest abstraction, a singularity, a line, and a surface, and what comes from that. It's literally, it tumbles out of your hand, a cornucopia, a geometric cornucopia tumbling out of your hand. The alphabet and all the forms in the world, and in science and in culture.
But that means that all of this current insanity, where ISIS is trying to kill other Muslims, and Muslims are, you know, ISIS is trying to kill Jews.
They're a-holes. Everybody knows that.
I don't think we can say that on the radio, okay?
But
in other words, what you have discovered, and Stan, this is mind-blowing. You're saying that if you follow these various traditions back from the most recent, which is Muhammad, to the most ancient, which is the Hindu, ultimately they're all telling us at the fundamental level the same thing.
It's pre-Hindu. The Hindu is derivative also. Let me give you the sequence. You know this from your own experience when you move and look for a new house or a new car. Everyone has the same experience. The first thing you do when you're searching for a new place to live is you make a list of what you want, the concepts. You get the concept clear in your mind. Then you get the newspaper and you go online and you start reading the ads and you start looking at apartments and houses and you do the legwork. You put in the effort. You carry the burden. And the very day that you give up on finding what you're looking for, that's when the phone rings and you get what you were looking for. Clear thinking, hard work, and letting go is the manifesting principle. Everyone uses it all the time. Seed, tree, and fruit. Conception, gestation, and birth. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam form a cycle. Judaism yields Christianity. Christianity yields Islam, and Islam yields Judaism. One of the fundamental purposes of Islam is the protection of Israel. I'm saying the Muslim scholars, the kids on their smartphones, will discover this for themselves pretty soon now. Not from us, not from your program, not from what I've been saying for 20 years. The the natural, the rational conclusion, the model, not a prophecy, this is a model. The model could be wrong, but the model says the seed of Judaism grows the tree of Christianity, which grows the fruit of Islam. When the fruit is on the ground, it rots and goes to war with the seed, which is what's happening now. But when the war is over, new fruit grows on the tree with a new womb, with new seed, which the fruit protects. And from that new fruit becomes the new cycle. Judaism, Christianity, Islam is a three-cycle, an embryonic cycle, a ternary, trinary count, just like the alphabet. This and it's going on right now, and we're embedded in it.
This is astonishing stuff, Stan. This is absolutely world-changing if people apprehend it. And you're saying that it doesn't have to be taught to the current generation. They will discover it on their own?
A Jewish guy from Brooklyn can't look into the Torah and come back and tell Muslims that their purpose is to protect Israel. That's going to go about as far as an ice cube at the equator. It ain't going to work. But the tradition says that this new generation, you can see it for yourself. The closest, simplest description of what's going on in the Mideast now is a fruit rotting on the ground, destroying itself 20 different diseases in 12 different directions. But when that fruit is dissolved, is finished, and the new season starts, new fruit starts to grow, and that new fruit protects its seed, and all of the previous stuff inverts, everything flips. And that's what's going to happen. I mean, I don't know that. I'm not a prophet. I'm saying the models of self-organization based on the golden rule and this understanding of the alphabet that we've recovered from Genesis and the Torah tradition is suggesting this model, and this model suggests this is what's going to happen.
And now, you're saying that other scholars like yourself, but from other traditions, if they'd had this insight, if they'd had this, I don't want to use the word channeling or whatever happened to you that made you look at that pattern after you saw the prisoner and want to look at Genesis, if they'd had a similar parallel experience in these other traditions, they would arrive at the same place eventually that you have arrived?
I think what we're looking at is each of these traditions is like a different organ in a global body politic. We each contribute something. We have a common DNA, but we do different jobs. We have different fuel. We have different metabolisms, and we have to trust that the others are doing their jobs. That this organic global model is the core model here, and that it's going to be discovered by everyone from their own perspective. What I did is how I came upon it. What happens in other cultures and other places is going to be different. There may even be different hand gestures in different locations. It's the principle of projecting your gestures to generate a dance, a meditation in the mind and in the world that you can experience and share with others and change the world by means of. We haven't talked about any of the physics here yet, but there's some very deep physics here. And I'm saying it's inevitable. And my methods are not going to be the methods that others use. Others will use different methods.
Well, given
but
that
it's happening very quickly.
Given that the major problem on the planet now seems to be that we're all separate fragments fighting each other because we've forgotten that we're all ultimately one, This is amazing.
What's the most widely spoken language on the planet?
I think it's English.
English. Do you know that you can translate English roots and Hebrew roots and they have the same meaning? If you take out the vowels, the Hebrew root for grow is zerah, Zion, Resh, Ayin. Zion is a G, Resh is an R, and Ayin is an O. Grow means grow. The Hebrew letter Aleph is the highest letter. It means the greatest abstraction. A-L-P is an Alp. It's a mountain. It's a very high mountain. It's and aloof. What?
I said, wow.
Yeah, wow.
Well, I mean,
English and Hebrew as the same system at the root level. And that's the most common language on the earth already is going to be the one that's going to continue to do what it's been doing, absorbing everything.
See, the remarkable difference between your work and what's coming is that your work was done almost in the Stone Age, where you had to take Polaroid pictures of little.
Well, that demonstrates that you don't need modern high tech to do it. If I'd used supercomputers to do it, what would it have told us about the ancient world?
But I have to use their techniques. But that's not where I'm going.
I have to limit myself to their techniques.
No, that's not where I'm going. Where I'm going is now. Other people in other cultures, like in Islam, have the advantage of social media, where what one person or 10 people find can communicate it around the world at the speed of light by tomorrow morning. So the painstaking decades of work you put into this, and the efforts to get scholars and academia and rabbis and the traditional, Hebraic researchers, even to begin to think about the possibility, will be so collapsed in time because, again, as people are hearing us and looking at those diagrams, it's going around the world at the speed of light on screens that are being held in hands by people we will never meet.
You think?
I know.
Let me tell you something. Why did I call the book The Alphabet That Changed the World? You don't know something. The past tense in the Torah language of Hebrew indicates the future. The alphabet that changed the world actually means the alphabet that will change the world.
Okay. Is that
It's the once and future alphabet.
Fascinating.
The once and future king.
Yeah, absolutely fascinating. Let me kind of get myself together here, because this is staggering. This means that all of what's going on now is totally pointless.
No, it's preamble.
But it's a preamble.
It's a preamble.
Can we shorten the preamble? Can we get to where people realize that they have so much more in common than they have separately? I mean, this ISIS cult has taken the most radical positions of Muhammad and is basically trying to bring on the end of the world.
Maybe the idea
of the end of the world is that, remember that famous song, The End of the World as We Know It?
That's right, it's the end of the metaphor. It's not the end of the world, it's the end of the metaphor of the world.
Interesting.
It's what changes is our worldview, not the world. We change, the world doesn't change.
Okay, let's go back to othersideofmidnight.com, Radio with Pictures. Let's look at number six. Click on number six, because I want you to, amplify on the golden rule and how we get that from these letter shapes.
Okay, let's bring that one up. It turns out, if you go through all of this time and effort, you can reduce everything that I've been discussing to two lines, a vertical line with a point on top and a horizontal line. And the horizontal line is understood as a one circle. It's intrinsically a circle, but in one dimension it's just a line segment. And that represents the vertical line is as above and the horizontal line is so below.
Ah.
And it turns out if you make that triangle, it fits the descriptions in all the Kabbalistic literature, and everyone's missed it. It turns out that the angle is given explicitly in many different places. I don't want to start with my book now, but it's explicit.
It only took you 30 years to write the book, Stan. I think we can plug the book, yes.
Well, not only is this the golden rule, but it actually also generates the numerical golden mean, the thing that I had to fight the nut over 20 years ago.
Oh, how interesting.
So it actually subsumes, it shows how even nasty people are working for the good, even though they don't know it. This jerk challenged me to discover what the actual shape was, which led to my finding what it was, which led to the meaning that we've got now. If he hadn't challenged me, I might not have gotten to this.
If one wanted to get metaphysical.
In any event, you take the initial model of as above, so below, and what goes around comes around. And you bring it up to 2D, the vertical line, the axis, is still a single axis, but the horizontal area becomes now a surface. You go into 3D, the axis stays the same, but the span becomes a volume, and then a hypervolume. And 1/6 of that hypervolume is the hand that I drew on the side of that ice bucket apple that generates all of the letters. And it's also described in the literature, mathematically, is it related to a 24 cell? And it turns out there was a reference that the Egyptians may actually have known that the 27 lines that solve the general cubic equation define the surface of a hypersphere. Now, I have a reference for that, but it's kind of hard to believe because they didn't have algebra, so they couldn't have said it that way. But they did have a way of understanding how the 27-letter system of the full alphabet defined the hyperdimensional space, and it turns out we've recovered now how that relates to consciousness.
So this incredibly sophisticated system you're now believing is descendant from a different world, a different culture, a different planet than the most ancient cultures.
It's perennial. It's like a living thing. It's rediscovered and lost and plowed under and rediscovered and grows and dies and plowed under and rediscovered and grows repeatedly. If there wasn't Atlantis, if there were earlier cycles, if there are aliens, they've got the same model because they deduced it the same way we did.
Which leads me now into my favorite subject. You made mention a moment ago in passing that this geometry, which is decoded through the letter shapes of the first verse of Genesis, also leads us to a physics. Can you expand on that?
I have a theory. It's in my book. Let's discuss how a Bose-Einstein condensate works.
All right. First, you have to define a Bose-Einstein condensate.
Well, here's how it goes. In modern physics and quantum mechanics, you have wave-particle duality, and you have the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, which tells you that the more accurately you know the velocity of a particle, the less you know about its location. And the more accurately you know its location, the less you know about its velocity. So if you know the exact location of something, you can't tell how fast it's moving. And if you know exactly how fast it's moving, you can't tell where it is. Now, you take a bunch of atoms that are close together in a crystal, perhaps, and you cool them down to absolute zero, which is as cold as you can get. And even if there's some minor residual motion, basically the velocity of all the particles goes to zero, which means their wave function, their location in physical space, spreads out enormously. So what may have been a microscopic atom at normal temperature in the dimensions of an atom could be an eighth of an inch in diameter or even wilder. In any event, the wave functions of the separate particles overlap each other. They entangle, they superpose, and they produce a new emergent quality.
So like the separate particles basically become one.
And that's the basis of the Bose-Einstein condensate and the special qualities of that condensate, which includes being a pool that's outside of time.
Now, just to define here, we have to define because the audience is not following, a lot of them have not had this as background.
They can Google it.
Bose-Einstein, B-O-S-E, dash, Einstein, refers to two physicists, famous physicists, Bose and Einstein, the Einstein, at the beginning of the last century, the 20th century, set out parameters whereby separate entities, separate atomic particles, could, under certain circumstances, behave as one particle.
Yes, the understanding of quantum mechanics that Bohr and Einstein and Dirac and Bose and the others were exploring leads to this idea, theoretically. It's been demonstrated these days. We use it all the time. It leads to superconductivity and superfluidity. You can do it in the lab. They're looking, trying to find room temperature superconductors now. They've gotten so good at refining these systems. But the principle is in physics, wave-particle duality. If you cool something down so the particles stop moving, then their location in space spreads out.
Well, hang on. If you can stop them, it means they spread out to infinity.
Yeah, well, you can't totally stop them, and there are other limits also. So this is a simplified, this is a toy model. We're doing it on the radio.
Okay, I'll tell you what, hold it there, because it's too complex to finish on this side of the break. My guests this morning are Stan Tenen and Lavanna Tenen, and we're basically talking about a revolution both in physics, a revolution in consciousness, and most intriguing for what we're now facing in terms of a fragmented world tearing itself apart over religion, We're talking about a unity, a oneness of religions that we can now look at mathematically and geometrically as all tracing their ideas, their precepts, their organizing principles, their guiding philosophies, all back to the same source. Not a bad idea for a world in desperate need of a new idea in replacement of the ideas we're currently dancing to and not too well. You're on the other side of midnight. You're listening to the Creation Overture by Daniel Gill, a symphony created from the first verses of Genesis by way of the geometry that Stan Tenen has discovered. My name's Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return.
Okay. Richard?
Shh. The other side of midnight. There's a very important rabbinic quote that I think Lavana's going to read, which encapsulates what we're discussing in terms of the body politic right now. Lavana?
One key idea. We're going to make the correlation between temperature and ego. Now read the quote.
Okay, this is a quote from historian Yehuda Libous, and he is writing about recapitulating Rabbi Chaim Vital, who was a great Kabbalist, on the subject of love among the companions, which means those are characters in the Zohar.
These are like disciples?
Okay.
The members of the Minyan are companions, and also those surrounding Muhammad were called companions.
Okay,
so here we are. Here is the quote. The idea that love must prevail among the companions was not confined by Lurianic Kabbalah to the theoretical speculative realm, and it did not apply only to Rabbi Akiva's disciples. Luria himself took pains to ensure that love would prevail among the members of his group. Before worshiping in the synagogue, an individual had to commit himself to the mitzvah of loving one's fellow so that all of the prayers of Israel would be combined together. Especially important, writes Chaim Vital, was the love of companions who study Torah together. Each of them must regard himself as though he were one part of the body of the group of his companions, especially if he has the knowledge and understanding to know his fellow soul. And my teacher cautioned me greatly about the need for love to prevail among the companions in our group.
You know, Stan, what this reminds me of? You know...
Well, let me finish it. The idea is that when people are loving of each other, they are not expressing their ego. They're not being willful. When you drop your willfulness, that's when your mind can merge with each other. It turns out flocking, schooling, and swarming in the animal world corresponds to what I'm proposing in the world of consciousness in the meditation traditions.
Now, wait. You have to go back and define that. Flocking...
It turns out if you examine the literature on flocking, schooling, and swarming in animals, it takes approximately 10 individuals for the flocking effect to cut in. It turns out that's the minimum you need for a minion to meditate in Hebrew, to say prayers together.
When you say minion, what are you meaning? Because I'm thinking of that movie.
10 adult Jews praying together in Hebrew.
Okay.
It's not the movie. It's okay. M-I-N-Y-A-N.
Okay, so what we're talking about here is group consciousness, which then, like a Bose-Einstein condensate, can actually lose individuality as part of the group of 10 or more, and then affect...
They all contribute to the emergence of a child that floats on the surface of the pool of dominion, exactly as described for Jesus walking on the water. We're describing Messiah emerging from the pool of dominion as the combination of the loving kindness of all the participants in the commune, in the ummah, in the minyan.
Well, that has an amazing...
All the Western traditions.
That has an amazing implication, because it's basically saying if you put yourself aside, if you get outside yourself, if you become part of a whole of like-minded...
And do particular exercises, you get particular results.
Okay, but that means that in terms of consciousness, as a consciousness experiment by a group, if you focus on creating activity in the real world, there's a tradition and a physics that backs up that this can actually take place. And someone has their phone on.
I'm proposing that the Bose-Einstein condensate model applies to the model of a meditating minion of people who love each other and care for each other and are not egocentric or controlling. That when you have a group of people that exceeds 10, who are mature adults, who can drop their differences and all look to the same high standard, the same goal, the same high principle, abstraction, one God. They're all that their consciousnesses add together like the particles, wave functions in a Bose-Einstein condensate, and you get a new emergent quality, which in the Christian tradition is described as the Messiah walking on the water. In Judaism, there are parallel descriptions because the Christian tradition got it from the Torah tradition, which is obvious, everyone understands. What I'm describing, if we use the proper respectful language, is satisfying and acceptable to Jews, Christians, and Muslims without insulting anyone. It's a win-win-win model, and it's also an explanation for the scientists that don't believe in anything, because you can model this in ways that we do understand rationally. By the way, Maimonides says that Abraham figured this out rationally before he did experiments in consciousness. First, he figured it out. He did the math first.
Well, what's so interesting about this is that we've been doing kind of like primitive consciousness experiments with, for instance, Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter discovered in August that he had cancer of the brain. A few days ago, the announcement was made. He made it himself in Sunday school, that the cancer apparently had disappeared. He's under an immunotherapy regimen. But in addition, there are people listening to this show who have been basically meditating on Jimmy Carter getting well.
Let me draw a line of caution here, though. This is all true. I understand it. I agree with it. But there is a caveat. If you brag about it, your ego becomes involved, and your contribution to making it happen decreases. So it becomes less likely to hold. So the idea is to not say that this is magic and happens every time. You have to let your ego, your expectations go to observe these effects. So you can't count on them. I have a meditation which we can describe and we'll go into in a future program if you want, where a peace person can experiment with this for themselves safely. And you don't have to believe anyone but your own experience. And it only works if you don't believe it going in. If you buy it going in, then it doesn't work. It only works if your rational mind is dead set against it.
Why is that?
Because that means your rational mind has given up control, which is the condition under which these things can happen. Well, loving kindness is the opposite of control.
Well, when this news suddenly broke, you know, I got a lot of emails saying, "Oh my God, our experiments and all that." And I cautioned everybody a few nights ago that we really don't know. That we really do not know. We have to look. I'm trying to accumulate, you know, the medical studies and look at other patients on the same drug and all this. But at least there's the possibility that we could focus intention. Wouldn't it be wonderful, Stan, if we could use this to basically change what's going on right now in the world?
Yes, and the key to doing it is to be able to distinguish sense from nonsense. So we have to do explicit experiments to determine what the lines, what the actual parameters are. It can't be everything that works. Some things work, some things don't work. Some things are sensible, some things are nonsense. If we do experiments in consciousness, and I can propose a few, then we can discover if this is real very quickly. We have the equipment to do it now. Everyone has a smartphone.
Mm.
We can all read our own EKGs and EEGs, and we can find out if we could coordinate our consciousness experimentally with some very simple protocols in the real world.
Why don't we set that up
but
for the next show?
It's not going to happen if we power trip it, because the whole thing is dependent on not power tripping it, okay. On not controlling it. The reason the skeptics never get results when they test anything psychological is because they are...
I think we lost you there, Mom.
Drop your ego investment.
Yeah, we actually dropped your call. Can you go back and reiterate that, please?
From where?
Hello?
Hello?
I don't know.
Hello?
Yeah, we have a caller on the line. I just popped up.
A caller.
Yeah, where are you calling from and who are you?
Hello, Richard. This is Glenn from Philadelphia.
Oh, hi, Glenn.
Hello. Thanks for taking the call. I'll be quick. Just woke up, just tuned in, and heard what you're talking about. Fascinating stuff. You were talking about the notion of unity among mankind and physics and stuff like that. And actually, I called in to mention that the unity you seek, the only transcendental unity in existence is Yahweh himself. Yahweh is the only God who gives his name to Moses on Sinai as the I am that I am. He is the transcendentally conscious one. And so this unity, you know, is inherent in the creator himself. And then I found out what you're doing actually has Kabbalistic connections and connections to physics and that sort of thing.
But I go further. I use the definition in Psalm 84, which says a sun and a shield is Hashem Elokim. It says that Hashem Elokim are not entities, but there's a gradient of loving kindness between the source and the sink. That we make the choices in the world, that what Hashem Elokim provides is a negentropic gradient that is the fuel for our being able to exercise our will and our control. When we let go of control, that's when that will can manifest in the most novel and miraculous ways. And if you don't let go of control, you get nothing. You get a sunburn. But this model says that neither God, neither Elohim nor Hashem are entities, are beings, are making choices, that the negentropic gradient between sun and sink, between source and sink, between sun and shield, that negentropic gradient is loving kindness, and when we let it flow,
Kanon, the first epistle of John, says Theos Esten Agape, God is love. So, and he certainly was Jewish. That probably was originally rendered in Hebrew. So would agree with that. Go ahead.
The premise of what I've been doing is that it agrees with these teachings, but I'm trying to find an understanding of how and why it's so, and how we can read the record we have to understand more deeply how it all fits together. So I'm agreeing with what you're saying as the results of what I'm saying, which is the foundation of our consciousness and our physics being the golden rule.
Right. You were just talking about the unity of consciousness producing something about like a child in the water, and this made me think of the Muslim prophecy of the Mahdi emerging from a well. You have a person and water
The well is associated with also the cave, Plato's cave, and the well. Mm-hmm. They're all elements of the same sacred geometry as explained in different cultural contexts. I allude to them in my book.
Now, my one great concern in terms of where humanity is actually going, if you look at the prophecies of Ezekiel and Daniel and Isaiah,
Do you know Ezekiel 37?
Okay,
Ezekiel
yeah.
Ezekiel 37 basically says there will be peace in the land when we have one God and one language. And the language comes from unifying the stick of Jacob and the stick of Ephraim. We've recovered the stick of Jacob and the stick of Ephraim, demonstrated how it generates a unified language from hand gestures, and that unified language then becomes the basis for a long cultures around the world. the key right, to understanding then, is common language.
We also have the prophecies of Damascus, the world's oldest continuously inhabiting city, being left to ruin its heap and the haunt of animals. Yeah. We have the Magog battle of Ezekiel 38 and 39, and, you know, that basically that things are going to get quite a bit worse before they get better. I personally believe Yahweh is personal and has looked down from his position of transcendence on the timeline of human history future and forewarned us of these things, which will ultimately, I would suggest, be fulfilled. I would much rather they not, but I believe he's told us the truth on these matters. But, all right, take care. Take care, General. I'll let you go. Bye.
Fascinating. Bye. Absolutely fascinating. Stan?
Yeah, what I'm trying to do is get behind these prophecies that come out in different versions in all our different faiths, and they all come on the same idea. Are you there?
Okay. We're here. Go ahead.
Well, it all is based on the golden rule, as I've demonstrated, come from these two simple lines, and I think that that's the most ancient form, and it's common in all these cultures. That's why we're finding it in Sufism, in Hinduism, in places where you'd never expect to see it. In the Bose Einstein, it takes the same form. The horizontal line is the pool of the condensate. The vertical line is the emergent quality. And that's how you see it in the diagrams in the physics books, because that's the way you illustrate it. It's the same geometry. And it shows up everywhere because it's of its fundamental nature. It represents the golden rules, as above, so below, and what goes around comes around, and their implications.
I think we have another caller. Where are you calling from?
Hi, Richard. This is Marcus. I'm calling from Flash X on the 4 channels here.
Okay.
We still, every night, 4chan, you know, we're part of the Anonymous Collective. And we put Mr. Tenen's work into our, you know, our computations and algorithms. And so far, you know, it looks like his work is corrupted. It's amazing to have a guest like this online.
Well, he will be back.
Yeah,
do you have any specific questions?
I can't understand what he's saying. I'm only getting broken up.
What about you? Can't talk over each other.
I can't hear him.
Oh, he's as loud as we can make him.
No, it's not loud. He's cutting in and out in mid-word. It's chopped. It's broken up. I can't hear it.
That's because when you talk, Skype kills other people talking. So let's all be quiet.
No. Go
ahead.
Anyways, Richard, as a member of Slash X here, I just want to know if you'd be our honorary dungeon master. We play dungeon master here at night and kill kobolds.
Think I have time, but thanks for the invitation, okay?
Take care.
Stan, we only have a few minutes left. If you had to summarize, and I want again to give the title of the book, The Alphabet That Changed the World, I like the past tense as future, How Genesis Preserves a Science of Consciousness in Geometry and Gesture. How can we put this into practice now in the face of what's going on globally?
Well, the first thing is to understand the principles, and the second thing is to do objective experiments that can be repeated so we can sort sense from nonsense for ourselves. And once we've got the parameters down, then you start doing the meditations and see what happens. It's experimental. You're going to try it. If it's real physics, it's not a matter of belief. It's a matter of doing the experiment.
Okay.
So that's what I'm proposing. And it all comes down to putting together groups of people who are caring for each other.
On the next time that you come on, if we could maybe set up beforehand some kind of experiments we could do via smartphones, digital stuff, so we could see if we actually can synchronize people on different parts of the planet.
It would be way premature.
Okay,
I couldn't do that at this point.
Okay,
it would give us noise. It would give us gibberish. We couldn't sort it. We need to get to. We'll talk about it.
Okay,
if you want to do it, we'll find a way to do it. But we can't do it quick and dirty. We have to be careful. After all, if it works, what if something happens?
Well, you have to be careful what you wish for.
Right.
Well, I mean, wouldn't it be kind of useful to wish that the current maelstrom we're immersed in has a positive resolution for everyone? I mean, isn't that kind of where you should approach this without directing?
But it's not a matter of wish. It's not, physics isn't about wishing. It's about doing. We need to take action in a coherent way based on a mutual understanding of what we're doing, so that what we do is coordinated in the same way as different organs in our body are coordinated.
While we
my
have
spleen, my spleen and my tonsils don't get a little, aren't close together, but they have to support each other.
Yeah, let's go back to that idea that we're not looking at one world religion. We're looking at the different existing great religions of the world as manifesting different aspects of the body of consciousness.
Different organs expressing different expressions of the same DNA.
Okay.
Common DNA, each organ has a different expression. Each culture has a different embodiment of the same principles. Each appears idolatrous to the others, but they meaning. And the key is respect. And that's exactly what it takes for flocking and swarming and schooling to take place. The creatures have to be attracted to come close, but not too close. It's in my book.
Obviously,
I use the flocking, schooling, and swarming model to explain how I think this Bose-Einstein condensate effect works in human consciousness. That's my explanation. It's not necessarily correct. It's a model. It's a metaphor. It might be correct, but it only needs to be a metaphor.
Let me, while we have a few minutes here, Lavana, did you want to say something?
No, I'm enjoying the conversation, actually.
Okay. While we have time, I wanted to quote a few more of the people who have looked at your work. And remember, everyone, the way science is gauged in our reality today is something called peer review, which means people who know enough to be able to make a considered judgment, take a look, and they either give thumbs up or thumbs down. Here's one from Lewis Kaufman, who is professor of mathematics at the University of Illinois in Chicago. Quote, in attempting to unfold the text of Genesis, Stan Tennant has created the beginnings of a wonderful geometric language using real and deep mathematical structures. The language is a new alphabet, an alphabet of geometric forms that may solve the riddle of Genesis. The geometric alphabet is itself not only a great artistic and conceptual value, but I believe it will be seen to hold a key for many other questions in language and science. This project brings together the old and fascinating questions about origins of language and the self with the rigorous traditions of modern geometric thinking and mathematical imagination. Not bad, Stan. Not bad.
You wrote that quite a while ago. That was before we understood that at the bottom of everything was golden rules. That was earlier than our current understanding. But Lewis is still a friend.
Well, the thing that's impressive to me is that it took you 30 years for a few of your friends, hint, hint, to get you to actually put all this down in a book. And the book is available from North Atlantic Books. There's a link to the book on othersideofmidnight.com on the guest page tonight. The Alphabet That Changed the World, How Genesis Preserves a Science of Consciousness in Geometry and Gesture. And if you go to the Meru, go ahead.
Richard, I wanted to thank you on the air for getting us from San Francisco to Boston 15 years ago, 18 years ago. It was your help that moved us. We had a truckload of stuff that we couldn't afford to move, and your friends and your connections, your supporters made it happen. Thank you.
Well, look, when you see someone doing what you've been doing, and I've been watching it painstakingly for decades, literally decades, as it's built toward this new crescendo of where we are tonight, it's kind of like a thing that's time has come. To me, the only real antidote for ISIS and all the other insanity, Trump notwithstanding, is love. And the fact that all the great religions are actually united underneath, and you can now prove it geometrically and mathematically, that they derive from the source, which is telling us this in overwhelmingly plain terms, is something that I think we need, and we need a lot of right now.
Yes.
Yes.
And we should discuss it further. And thank you again. And this has been a wonderful opportunity. If people have questions, send them to us. We'll try to respond.
I'll tell you what. We have got a couple of minutes here. Where are we? I didn't do that right. So I can't do what I was going to do. So do you have something you wanted to say?
No, I was saying...
Oh, actually, I actually can do this, okay? So what I'd like to do is to go out on playing a little more of the Creation Overture by Daniel Gill, because to me, the idea that you can create music from Genesis, and the music has pattern and form and beauty and is awesome in its majesty and is based in a reality, to me, that is stunning. Stan, thank you for your work. Lavanna, thank you for your support of Stan. And I'll tell you what, everybody, why don't we just let this music take us out tonight as opposed to playing our traditional theme? You're on the other side of midnight. My name is Richard C. Hoagland, and we shall return tomorrow night, same time, same station, with something that, well, you should look forward to. Until then, stay tuned.
You want us to hang up?
Yes.
We'll hang up. Bye-bye.